Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This is your moment. Your time to shine. Your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, Shalana!
Whoa!
This is Ethnically Ambiguous. Wowie, wowie, wowie.
It's
okay. Introduce our guest, Shereen.
Yeah, okay. We recorded such an amazing conversation just now. I cannot wait for you guys to hear it. We were joined by Bridget Todd. She's in D.C. right now. We talk about her life and her upbringing in Virginia and how she landed in podcasting. We talk about sexuality. It is such a good conversation. Mm-hmm. I can't wait for you to hear it. She's right here with us, listening to everything I'm saying.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so excited, guys.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hey, Anna.
Hey, Shereen. This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Yeah, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. Thank you for joining us again today. Whenever you're listening to this, we're joined remotely. This time, it's someone we've known for a while.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the podcast world, maybe you know her for a while too. And we're all looking at each other on our computers right now, so I might as well just bring her in. It's Bridget Todd!
Yeah. Hello! Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be joining y'all, even virtually. You all look amazing. Listeners, you can't see this.
Oh my God.
Both of them look so dewy and glowy on the Zoom. It's amazing.
Thank you. I've had nothing to do but put aggressive amounts of like skincare on because that's all
right.
I have.
Yeah. Yeah. I've tried to do the same, but before we started recording, I was showing the girls my pimples that are forming. I am also wearing a robe right now. I don't know. I'm just trying to really settle into this life. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. For those of you that don't know Bridget, well, I guess, okay, let's just rewind a little bit. I met Bridget the first time ever. I think you were either visiting LA. Back then you were hosting Stuff Mom Never Told You.
And
that's right. It had to have been like 2 years ago, right?
It was a while ago. Yeah, it was. I mean, at this point, who can even keep track of what day it is? But that sounds right.
Yeah. And we connected. And I feel like we wanted to get you on the show. Every time you came to LA, it just never worked out, I think. So better late than never. But since then, you've worked on a ton of different projects, podcasts and otherwise. But let's start with, where are you right now and where did you grow up?
Well, first of all, thank you for that lovely introduction. Right now, I am in my very messy apartment in Washington, D.C. Shout out to D.C., Columbia Heights. But I grew up in a pretty small town in Virginia called Midlothian, Virginia. You've probably never heard of it. It's about 20 miles or so outside of Richmond, Virginia, which is the capital of Virginia. Okay. It's kind of a little different now, but when I was growing up, it was like a small town that like no one had ever heard of.
Okay. What? Nice. What? Say it again. It's middle. Yeah. What is it?
Midlothian. It sounds like a something out of like Middle Earth or something.
Yeah.
I can give you a fun fact about the town where I grew up. If you've ever seen the movie Donnie Darko, the town where the movie takes place was based on my hometown of Midlothian, Virginia. I would say it's very accurate.
Wasn't that town called Middlesex in the movie?
It was called Middlesex, yeah.
Ah, Middlothian.
Wow.
So how did you...
I don't know if that's like a great representation. Like, I don't know if that's like... Because the town wasn't really depicted in a great way. It was kind of bleak.
It was pretty bleak. I will say this. I think that they nailed... There's a certain kind of like angst that you feel or kind of anxiety that I felt growing up there that I think the film does a good job of nailing. You know, there's like a scene where the bus is going down the street and it's just like every day feels like it's going to be the same. That sort of like, you know, that feeling. I mean, I don't know where you two grew up, but like the feeling that you have of like, I am trapped in this, in where I'm at, and like every day is going to be the same and like, this is it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I remember feeling when I was growing up.
How did your parents end up there?
Well, that's actually a good question. So my folks, they lived in D.C. for a long time. My mom went to medical school in Richmond, and then she did her residency at a hospital here in D.C. while my dad was finishing college also in the D.C. area. And, you know, my parents were these, like, very cool, radical Black activists who, like, never met a cause they didn't want to get involved in, like, very community-oriented. And it was one of those things where my dad likes to joke that when my mom was my age, she was always like, oh, I'll never leave the city. Like, I'm going to be born in, I'm going to, like, die in D.C. I'm never moving to the suburbs. And then as soon as she had her first child, she was like, get me out of D.C. I want to be in the suburbs. Get me out of here. So, yeah, we moved from D.C. Where my brother and I were both born pretty early on. I don't really have any memories of being in D.C. as a child, but... we resettled to Midlothian, Virginia, a small suburb, very white. It's a very, very white suburb. And yeah, it was an interesting upbringing. I left as soon as I could. I mean, no offense to Midlothian, Virginia. And I appreciate that my parents, you know, wanted to make a certain kind of life for their kids. But I turned 18 and I got the fuck out of there immediately.
As you do.
Well, yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I felt the same way about my hometown. I think there's a certain part of you that just wants to leave where you grew up. But you mentioned that it was very white. So what was that like for you, just like growing up being a Black woman in this very white suburb?
Yeah, what a good question. I would say I always felt like my family was sort of like that people thought of my family as like that weird family on the block. You know, my parents were very into the idea of their kids retaining their cultural identity. So we grew up taking, you know, Swahili lessons and like African dance classes and things like that. And like looking back now, I completely appreciate that. And I'm so glad that my parents kept those things going, kept those things alive. But at the time, you know, when you're young, you just want to be the same as everybody else. You don't understand the things that make you and your family and your culture special necessarily. You don't understand how precious those things are yet because you're young and you just want to be like everybody else. So when I was growing up, I was just like, wanted to fit in. And really, I would say I wanted to like, not even fit in, like fade away. I just wanted to be in the background. But so many different things from our race to the way that my family expressed our cultural heritage to like being very tall and like having like big hair made it really impossible for me to fade into the background when, you know, and at the time that was all I wanted to do.
That's actually a great way of putting it. Like you don't realize how special your culture is and how those differences actually make you more interesting, because when you're young you're like, fuck this. You're like, I will not eat this smelly food in front of people. Fuck this.
Right.
You're like so angsty and your parents are like, don't you understand, like we're pretty cool, and you're like, no, we are not.
You don't see it until much later.
I think, I mean, it's honestly, this makes me feel so, I feel so good having this conversation because it's one of those things that even now as an adult, I have this weird, I don't know if guilt is the right word, this, I have this weird baggage around the way that I felt about it when I was younger and I just didn't know. You know, mm-hmm. I wish, you know, if in the perfect retelling of Bridget Todd's story, I was this like 12, 13-year-old who was like completely down to be, you know, so different and outspoken and stand out. But that wasn't the case at all, you know. And part of me, even as an adult, carries a little bit of like guilt for how weird I was around it. But I'm so glad that as I got older that I see how beautiful and how special our cultural distinctions make us. I'm so grateful to have that. And I'm so grateful that my parents, oftentimes with their kids kicking and screaming, preserved that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like that's potentially why we started this podcast, because I think Shireen and I kind of grew up the same way, where we were like kind of smothered by like Islam or like our cultures, feeling like we couldn't fit in and, you know, wanting to appreciate what our parents gave us. But at the same time, just like being like, I don't get why I'm being othered. Like, this sucks. And but then like we grew up and we were like, well, damn, dude, like we might as well give back. And like, our thesis for this, all we always go back to, is like, we made the show to tell other people, like, you're not alone when you're growing up like this. Like, we all went through it and we came out on the other side and we're thriving. So it's like nice. That's like kind of where, I mean, you're perfect for this podcast version.
Oh, I'm so happy.
No, but it's totally right. I think like the more we tried, or at least I tried, to like hide in the background or pretend I wasn't a person of color, the more it like was obvious, like whether it was like going through puberty and having hairy eyebrows, or my accent growing up, or like, I remember I hated going to the mosque and going to Arabic school when I was a kid. And now I'm so grateful that I know Arabic. Like, I'm so grateful that I can read and write in Arabic. It's like, I'm so thankful that my parents pushed us to like maintain that and to maintain our language, maintain our culture, because growing up, you think it's like this ostracizing, really weird thing, especially if you're made fun of for it. Like my older sister and I, we got made fun of for our accents all the time. We got made fun of for the clothes we wore because, I don't know, my mom liked to dress us up in like cute little immigrant children outfits. And looking back on it, every photo was like adorable. But at the time, you are bullied and like you think it's because you're different, and then you grow up and you realize like those differences make you so interesting, so unique, and you can use them as a strength, you know, because we wouldn't be the people we are if we were just like, I don't know, the same as everyone else. So I just think I really liked what you said about your features or your characteristics, like they didn't allow you to even go into the background. Like, it was hard, especially because mm-hmm. I mean, it was even worse for you because you're a black person and surrounded by white people. It's like you and everyone is just like everyone can see when you're in the fucking room, and it's like, oh, there she is. So so growing up, was there a certain point, maybe like in high school or something, like who did you gravitate towards? Who were your friends? Because you still ended up wanting to leave, but was there ever kind of like people that you still were able to connect with as a teenager?
Definitely. This is like bringing back so many memories. I remember being in like high school and feeling so alone, feeling like nobody understood me and blah, 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 all the things you feel when you're young. But I actually was so lucky that I did have a community of like friends, other black girls in my class, you know. So I went to all-girl Catholic school that was mostly white, but actually like we had a fairly big population of non-white people for being a white private Catholic school. And, you know, we all sat at the same lunch table. It was like the people of color lunch table. Like, we all sat at one big table. And I think that oftentimes, because when I was young and I was self-absorbed and narcissistic in the way that young people tend to be, I assumed that I was feeling all these feelings alone. And that I would make these friends and I would assume like, oh, well, I'm happy that I have her, but she doesn't know what I'm going through. And in fact, we were all going through so much of the same stuff. And, you know, one of my best friends, Taryn Hall, who is a phenomenal podcaster, a phenomenal community organizer, we met when I was 15 and we're still friends today, you know. And so I'm so lucky that, honestly, I just feel like I got very lucky. I think in a lot of iterations of the story of like, a young black queer woman kind of like figuring out who she is in a white southern town. In a lot of iterations, that story doesn't go so well. And I'm like very, very privileged and very, very lucky that my story actually went fine. Like I had moments where I felt alone. I had moments where I felt really unsure. And Lord knows I still feel them. But for the most part, I feel like I really lucked out into the community that I found as a youth.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that makes me feel so happy.
You do not realize that people like around you are feeling that same thing. And that's, I think I had the same thing where I'd be like, I felt like I couldn't connect to anyone, but like probably had I just asked around, people would be like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's so hard to even like talk about those feelings because you feel like ashamed and like uncool for having them to begin with. Like, yeah. You just have to, like, bottle it all up yeah. and be like, just keep your head up and keep moving and don't let anyone see you, like, your weakness. Because a lot of that bullying tends to stem from people, like, picking on your weaknesses.
Definitely, definitely. I think that's true. I think that so many of us are going through the same thing. That's why I'm happy that podcasts like yours exist, because it does help people understand that they're not alone. And whatever feeling they're feeling, someone out there has felt the same thing. And so, you know, someone out there is listening to your show that y'all do, and it is making them understand that they're not alone and that maybe they are geographically, there aren't people who think like they do, who feel like they do, but they're out there somewhere. And I think that can be a real source of hope for people. When you're growing up in a town where you don't see yourself reflected, you don't feel comfortable, you don't feel like you can even be honest with yourself about who you are and show up in that way, you guys are creating content that can help someone deal with that and help them feel less alone. So I think that what y'all do is so important.
Thanks so much. Thank you. That's so nice. I am thinking about something that you said that I want to circle back to only because I've been stewing on it since you said it. But you said that in a version of your story, you would have been like a young kid that was really proud of who you are and all this other and all this stuff. And I was thinking about it and I was like, yeah, that would have been nice if I was like that too. But the reason why we weren't like that is because we had no examples of people like us. We had no examples of people that were strong and proud of being who they were. And you and I are queer, and I never saw a queer Syrian woman in my life. And I was very ashamed of myself. And I think it's so much easier to be proud of who you are when you're a kid if you see examples on media and TV. If you see yourself reflected, that means you can be proud. But I think the reasons why we weren't these rambunctious, really proud kids is because we had to really be the people that we needed. Like we're right now the grown-ups that we needed when we were younger, which is crazy.
Absolutely. I'm like nodding my head so vigorously.
Yeah. I just wanted to bring that up because I don't want you to feel like I'm also talking to myself. I'm like therapizing myself. It's like, it's okay that we weren't out there and proud 24/7. We had to work to be strong. You know what I mean? We had to really go through it to see ourselves at the other end and be like, we're actually not as alone as we thought, because being vulnerable unifies us. And you can't just like jump to vulnerability. You have to kind of like experience some like trauma, to be honest. But
absolutely.
But yeah.
I mean, I remember being very young. So, like, I grew up in the South. Some people say that Virginia is not the South. Those people are wrong. It is the South. And when I was growing up, like, I understood that, like, from – this was never, like, an overt conversation. But from the signals that I got from everybody around me, I understood that there was nothing worse that someone could be other than like gay, right? Like if you were gay, like I understood from a very early age that like there was nothing worse that you could be. And what's funny is that when I was young, like you said, I certainly didn't see a lot of, you know, black and brown queer women like living out loud, right? The person that I would say who I like really latched onto was the singer-songwriter Tracy Chapman, right? And so when I was young, I would stay up really late, you know, thinking about my life and thinking about that Tracy Chapman song, Fast Car. And if you listen to that song, it's one of my favorite songs, and even to this day, like, it gives me chills. But the life that she's depicting in the song, Fast Car, is actually not, like, a very happy life. Like, the whole song is about her like just trying to get out of her like town, meeting someone, having these fleeting moments where like things feel good, but like knowing that those moments are fleeting. And, you know, I remember thinking when I was a kid, like, if you grow up and you're queer or you're gay or you're a lesbian or whatever, that means that your lot in life is pain. Your lot in life is, you know, toil and struggle. Like, from a very early age, I understood that these things that made me different meant that I was never going to have a happy, dynamic life. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to me that I was so resigned to this idea that I would live and die in my tiny town, that I would never know, like, true, long-lasting, meaningful happiness. And that was just, like, because of the various identities that I occupied. And that was, like how I deeply, deeply felt at like 11. You know, it's a very specific kind of 11-year-old who was like, well, my life will never be happy, I guess.
Wow, that's pretty cool. You were like a very like emo. I was the same way.
I mean, I really relate to that. Like, I was so depressed at a young age because of the same thing. Like, I'm nodding my head very vigorously on my end now because it's like, I 100% felt what you felt. Like, I like thought I was doomed to be alone. Like, I thought I was, and then I tried to turn it on its head and be like, well, I'm a robot. I have no emotions. I'll always be alone. I can never be loved because I have all these things that make me unlovable. And I don't know. It's so fucking insane. Like, what you said about songs, I remember I would latch on to songs that were kind of like gender bending, or like when they wouldn't mention the gender of the person they were singing about, I was like, ooh, like this could be about anybody. Like this could be about this female singer could be singing about a girl. And like, I remembering those songs and like latching on to them because I don't know. It was just like, I was reaching to feel less alone, you know?
That is interesting that you thought you would never leave your town, though. Because I remember being, like, really emo and thinking, like, oh, as soon as I can, I'm going to blow this joint. Which actually didn't happen too well because my dad forced me to go to the university in our town. But I was, like, the second I graduated college, like, I applied for like 100, like I knew always deep down, like I was like, I might be depressed, but wait till I get a car. It's going to be like smoked on the wheels. I'm out of here.
Like, I'll be depressed in LA, motherfuckers.
Yeah. I was like, I knew I won't stay here. Like and it was always weird to me when people would be like, I'm going to get married and I'm going to work for my dad's business or like my parents' company. I'd be like, dude, we got to get out. We got to break out of this joint, man. Like I was like in prison, which, you know, as a child, you feel like you are. But why did you think you wouldn't leave?
That's a good question. I think I saw so few people leaving. Like it just wasn't. I think that I thought I would never leave my hometown because I just didn't see – I didn't have a lot of models for people who were doing that. Yeah. Honestly, all the models that I had for people who were leaving and, like, starting lives in exciting places were all on TV, all fictional. Mm. Like, all the people that I identified with were, like, fictional characters. And where I grew up – it's a bit different now, but where I grew up, it was – very, very common to graduate high school and then go to Virginia Commonwealth University, which is a college that my parents both attended for a while. Like, it's a perfectly good school, but it's, like, a bit like the 13th grade, you know? It was, like, that was, like, the college where most of the people that I graduated with went.
Yeah.
And it was very common to, like you said, like, get a job in your family's company. Like, a lot of my classmates, their parents had companies in our town, or, like, I would say that the professions that I saw my peers going into most after high school would be like a teacher in our town or a nurse in our town, like very much sort of practical vocations. And so, you know, when I was in school, like I wasn't a very good student. Like I didn't get great grades. And so I thought that the path that I had created for myself as being someone who was like a fairly mediocre student, the ship had sailed on me being a nurse, or the ship had sailed on me being like a fifth grade teacher in my town. I genuinely thought like I might graduate college and get a job, you know, as a I guess I just didn't have very exciting vocations for myself. And I just didn't think it was possible. And I didn't see people like me. I didn't see people around me doing that. And yeah, I also think it's a bit of a cultural thing. In my family, it's very common to just stay in your hometown. It's very common to live with your parents.
Yeah.
Even after you're married, like I'm sure y'all can relate. Like it's, and so the idea that you would finish high school, go someplace else for college, and then never come home again. Yeah. I think it really was, I was a bit of an outlier in my family as a girl child who did that. And I think that for my parents, my mom especially, it took a little bit of, I don't know how to put it, like, She really had to make terms with the fact that I was a little bit of a person who marched to her own drum, you know, and I was going to do things my own way, and that it wasn't the way that her sister's kids were doing things, and that was okay. I think it really took a lot of understanding on my parents' part as I got older and, you know, got into increasingly obscure vocations like podcasting.
Yeah.
I mean, what y'all are both podcasters. Do your parents like know and understand and get what you do, or are they like, I don't know what they do for a living?
My dad just tells everyone I'm a producer, and that's it. I don't think he has any sense of anything. Like, I think they kind of know now because my dad came down and I took him to the office and like showed him the studios. But even so, he was like looking at like Jack Miles and Sophie, and being like, "These are your coworkers," and I was like, "Yes, we all work in this office together. What do you think this is?" And he's like, "Weird." He's like, it's just you guys? Yeah. And I'm like, Dad, they can hear you. You know, like, he was being so like, huh, and who are you people? Like, I was like, Dad, Jack's my boss. Yeah. Like, chill out.
Yeah.
Like, no sense of what was going on.
Yeah, my parents took a little bit to understand what it was. But they get it. They get it. But I want to talk more about you leaving your hometown. But let's take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back with Bridget Todd.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
And we are back with Bridget. We had just talked about our parents not really understanding what we do. And for me, I just realized, like, it took them a while for them to realize, like, because I do freelance production, freelance filmmaking, I'm a director. And I think they tell their friends, like, they, like, latch on to one word and they're like, oh, she's a director. Oh, she's a producer. Oh, she's this. So I think there's just, like, one word they just use to, like, just describe me for a while. I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. There's just, but, like, that's what happens when you're, like, so multifaceted. Like, they can't really keep up. And especially in this, like, new age of stuff. But they do what they can. They're understanding. They're supportive. And we love them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so you ended up leaving your hometown at 18. You pushed that barrier open. Did you go to DC? Like, what did you do after you graduated high school? Did you go to college? What did you do?
So after I graduated high school, I graduated from St. Gertrude High School in Richmond, Virginia. Then I went to undergrad at East Carolina University, which, again, you've probably never heard of. It's not a small school. It's just like a very regional school in eastern North Carolina. Go Pirates. Honestly, it's definitely more toward the south than Virginia is on the southern meter.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a strange college choice for me because I definitely wanted to be, I was like done with the South. I wanted to be someplace new. But also my cousin went there and like we were always very close and he was a year earlier than me. So like I was like, oh, I could go to college with my cousin. They were giving me money to go to like defer the cost. So I was like, oh, I can't like turn that down. And I think I just like wasn't ready to be out of the South. I was ready to be out of my hometown. But I guess I like was a little afraid to like really like leave. And weirdly, I had an amazing college experience. I am so grateful and so happy for the college experience I had. You would think that, you know, going further into the South, you know, going to this, it was a cool college, but it definitely had that white frat dude vibe. Like that was a very common vibe. But I happened to be going there at a time where there was a lot of, for lack of a better word, weirdos. Like I fell into a crew of like art folks and music folks and like just like weird people. And I'm very lucky that I found the community that I did there because it really, I don't know if I'd even be doing any of the stuff I'm doing today if I had not fallen in with the crew that I fell into in college.
Yeah. I feel the same way because I mean, Shereen and I met at UC Davis. But my dad forced me to go to UC Davis. I really wanted to go to Santa Cruz because all my friends were going to Santa Cruz. My dad was like, no child of mine's going to be some stoner hippie. And I was like, okay, like I can still do that in Davis. You realize that, right? But he like forced me to go. But like it ended up being a great experience. Like I met Shereen. Like I met all these great people. And
how did you two meet?
We were in the same major. We were just taking classes together. Yeah. Like we did a few study groups together.
We were artsy weirdos. Yeah. We were like the artsy weirdos. Like there was a good amount of people at Davis that were just in the best. Like I love the word weirdos. Like I think it's like a really good thing to be not normal and kind of weird. And I'm so grateful there were so many of them in Davis. And even in LA, there are so many people that we still know down here that went to Davis. Like Allison Stevenson is like fucking amazing, and I met her at Davis and she was like in the improv team. There are so many amazing people down here that went to Davis, and so we met doing the same artsy thing, and then we just reconnected in LA.
It was actually, that's a good school to go to, and I think you'll agree with this, Shereen, because it's a science school. It's agriculture, it's engineering, they're really into their vino culture. It's just so science. So when you're in the arts in that school, it's like a really tight-knit community. Like everyone knows each other because you're like, oh, we're like the weirdo art kids off at the very, very back at the campus, you know? Like truly the art class, like they were like, you had to go so far to get to the art buildings because they're like, okay, weirdos, go all the way over there. So like the people you got to know, you got close with and you felt like you could work with them creatively because you guys were all on the same level.
Yeah, I will say that as much as I really agree with that, I'm a little pissed off because the film major, because I had a double major in film, and the film major was not very good when we were there. It was like more theory based. And as soon as we left, they like made it more practical. They like revamped, like the year we left was the year that they revamped the whole major. And it was like very practical. They were giving out cameras. Like I'm so envious of the people that studied film that were like given equipment because we never did that. It was more just like,
you had to do. So I doubled in film and then I doubled in technicultural studies. And that was the more hands on, like you had to do that. But that was also like an experimental arts major. So like I couldn't even tell my parents I was doing that. Like I lied and was like, it's computer science, whatever. Because they were like, they're not paying attention. But like actually the first classes in audio that I took like intro to sonic arts where all we did was make experimental audio music because all our teachers were just like these weirdo experimental artists. But like that was like truly where I found out, like I was like, fuck yeah, let's just record ourselves meowing for hours and then we'll like turn it in. The teacher
honestly,
will be like,
I'm so
interesting. And then that's like
I should have done that major too.
I learned how to use a mixer and stuff like that through that, those courses. And then it's a weird thing that I found my way to podcasting eventually.
See, this is what I always tell people, like young people sometimes ask me for career advice or like, how did you get to what you're doing? And I always say, you never know what weird little, you know, pit stop is actually going to be foundational for you. Like you probably, when you took those courses in learning, like learning how to use a mixer, you probably didn't know that you would go on to be like a well-known executive producer for the largest podcast company in the United States.
Oh,
you're probably just fucking around. You're probably like, oh, I'm like going to fuck around with this. We'll see. My advice for all people who are like figuring it out, like do those things. It may sound weird. Like take the experimental class, like learn the thing. At worst, you'll be like, oh, it turns out I hate audio editing and I never want to do it again. And now you know that. Or it could be like, I have a real flair for this. Or it could be 3 years later, good thing I took this class and I know how to do X, Y, Z. Like you truly never know what random thing is going to be a foundational thing for your life. So I think that what you did really does like illustrate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty random, but it worked out.
It is very random.
It worked out.
Especially because like even just the reality of like I didn't want to go to Davis either. Like I really wanted to go to Berkeley. I wanted to get as far away as San Diego because I went to high school in San Diego and I wanted to get as far away as possible. And I was only allowed to apply to schools in California, even though I really wanted to go to like NYU or Chicago for an art school, but I wasn't allowed. And I got rejected from Berkeley, and that really was a blow to my ego. And so I went to Davis without ever seeing it. I had never seen it before in my life, but it was the furthest school that I got into. And that's why I chose Davis.
Whoa. So you didn't like visit ahead of time?
I had never seen it. No, it was the furthest one. That's why I chose Davis. Wow. It was the farthest from my house.
It's so funny. We all had this vibe of like getting the fuck out of where we were raised.
Literally 9 hours away. Like I was like, this is as far as I can get. Okay, fine. But I didn't tell my parents that I selected Davis before I did it. I just did it. And then I was like, well, I'm going far away. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
That's how you do it. You gotta keep it a secret.
Like, look at us now.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to you a little bit. Let's go back to you. So you went to college.
Gladly.
You stayed in Virginia. How did you?
So I went to college in North Carolina.
Oh no, sorry. I meant the South. I meant you stayed in like the
South. Yeah, the South generally. Yeah.
But how did you like? What did you end up studying and like graduating with? And how did you find yourself in the podcast sphere?
Yeah, it's really my entire career has been a study in back doors and accidental shit and like falling into shit. You know, my undergrad degree was in English and women's studies. So basically like majoring in unemployment. My parents begged me like, please take a business class. Like, please like something. So when I finished college, I really didn't know. I didn't have a plan. You know, I just was excited to try new things and like write and like learn things. I didn't really have a plan for what I was going to do after. So like many people who don't have a plan, I thought I'd go to grad school. So I applied to graduate schools when I was, I think, a junior in undergrad. Early on, I applied to graduate schools. And for whatever reason, my application process went very well. Like I ended up getting into a lot of good programs, getting a lot of funding. And so at this point in my life, I was like, oh, well, this is a sign. I was meant to get a PhD in literature and be a professor. So that was my like life goal that I had decided on when I was, maybe I was 21 when I was doing these applications, very young. And I ended up, my two choices were between University of Maryland and University of Washington. And I ended up going to University of Maryland. And, you know, when I got to University of Maryland, it was a really tough time because I really nailed undergrad. Like I was like the girl everybody knew on campus. I did the paper. I had my own radio show. Like I was like, you know, like full of piss and vinegar. Like I was like there to take over the campus. When I got to graduate school, I realized how in over my head I was. I really was like, I was struggling to keep up with the assignments. I was, you know, clearly the bottom performer in my program, like all the time. And you know, would it come so easily for me in undergrad, you know, getting good grades and being someone that people looked up to and liked and, you know, being a notable student came really easy as an undergrad. In graduate school, it was really hard. Like, I was really, really struggling. And I had to, and it was t- tough for me because I got like a really wonderful fellowship package to study at University of Maryland. And so, you know, they were I wasn't paying a dime to take classes. They were paying me. And as I fell further and further behind in my pursuit of this degree, I realized I didn't want to be here. Like, I would wake up every day and be miserable. I would go to class and be like a kind of miserable that I had never felt before, where I just felt so behind and I was like watching my classmates just seemingly like nail it. And I realized that I was only kind of staying in. A lot of it was because of my family. Like, I knew they were very proud of me for wanting to get a PhD. They were so, like, it was the first time that I felt my parents, I felt that, like, family pride of, like, watching your mom tell someone, like, oh, my daughter is getting a PhD. You know, I realized I was doing it for those reasons. And those are the wrong reasons to do anything. You know, my parents, God love them, they're not the ones who were taking the exams, who were staying up late, who were like crying in the library. That was me doing all of that stuff. And I will never forget, this is kind of dated now because fuck Kanye West, but I went back to my apartment and I put on that album, College Dropout, and I just listened to it on repeat over and over and over and over again. It might have been hours. And I was just like, after that night, I knew I have to leave this program. I have to drop out. And that's what I did, you know, dropping out of my PhD program. At the time, I was like, I've ruined my life. I had this one shot to be somebody that was successful, somebody that was like a somebody. Like, I felt like I had really my one chance to do something with my life had come and gone, and I had like squandered it. And so at that point in my life, I was like, well, maybe if I'm lucky, I can get a job as like an administrative assistant somewhere, or like, you know, I was just looking for a job. And it's so funny to me because I really did feel like my life was over. Like, I had like wasted my chance. And then from there, I ended up getting a job teaching at a college in D.C., Howard University. Shout out to Howard. And that job teaching like saved me. Like, I had never had a career that felt so right before. Like, being in front of, you know, students at a historically Black college, I just felt like I came alive for the first time. You know, I changed my license plate. I got one of those personalized license plates that said "Love to Teach." Like, I was that lady, right? Yeah. And yeah, that really sparked a whole new vibe for me, opened a whole new door for me. You know, from there, as much as I loved teaching, I realized that I probably couldn't do it forever because I wasn't really making a lot of money, and it was good work, but like, I had to still, you know, work at a coffee shop in the summers and on the weekends, and it just was too much. And from there, I got very invested in activism and politics, and so I started working as an organizer and, you know, training myself in how you become a community and grassroots organizer. And I realized, like, there actually is a whole world out there, and that I didn't, you know, I could do so many other things that I didn't realize I could do. From there, I got my first job on a podcast. This was probably in like 20, might have been like 2012. This was like the, like, way, way, way back then. It was for a podcast put on by the political organization MoveOn.org. It was called The Flaming Sword of Justice, and it was all about sort of social change fights. This was in the, like, early days of podcasting. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing. We were counting analytics by hand, and It was a mess. It was a mess. But yeah, like, from there, I just realized my calling in life is telling stories and talking and having conversations with people that help them understand the world around them. And so from the activism slash organizing slash, like, lefty progressive world, I ended up getting my first co-hosting gig at, you know, then How Stuff Works, now iHeartMedia, with Stuff Mom Ever Told You, which was, like, really just such an amazing fit because, you know, I had studied women's studies and feminist theory my whole life, and the chance to talk about it on a podcast, I was so excited. And yeah, the rest just sort of fell into place. I'm so grateful for my mistakes, because if I hadn't, you know, gotten into that graduate program and then dropped out, who knows where I would be. So I really am so lucky that I embraced failing. I embraced dropping out. I embraced, you know, not really being sure what I was going to do. I embraced sort of like people being like, oh, what do you do for a living? And me being like, I don't actually know. You know, I embrace that. And I feel like that's how I got to where I am today.
I have a question. How did you get connected to the Stuff Mom Never Told You people?
Oh, so funny story. I was working for an organization that I really loved called Medium. It's still around. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, they ended up like closing a bunch of their offices and like restructuring and reorganizing. And so I really was like, they laid everybody off. They gave us a phenomenal severance. And so I was like, well, I really don't have anything going on. I have nothing. I don't have any prospects. I have nothing to do. Someone that I knew who lived in Australia was like, well, I'm doing a training for human rights activists in Australia. Do you want to come to Australia for a month and like help me train human rights activists? And I was like, sure. So I got on a plane to Australia. I really just like didn't know. I had never been out of the country before. It was just like a totally new thing. While I was in Australia, I got an email from a friend of mine, Emily, who was like, are you still looking for a job? I see that you're in Australia. Are you moving there? Like, what's the deal? And I said, yeah, I'm still looking for a job. I'm only in Australia for a month. I don't know what I'm doing after. Like, you know, if you have ideas, let me know. She had been contacted by a producer at How Stuff Works to come on as a host of Stuff Mom Never Told You. And I asked her, like, do you have anybody in mind that would be a good co-host? We were buds from living in D.C. and working in, like, progressive circles. But the fact that she immediately thought to contact me, to this day, I'm, like, shocked by that. Because I guess outwardly I thought of myself as someone who was, like, kind of a mess. And the fact mm-hmm. that she was like, no, you'd be perfect. Yeah. And so, yeah, like, from Australia, I had these, like, calls with folks from HowStuffWorks/iHeart. The time difference in Australia is crazy, so it was, like, for me, it will be like 5 a.m. on a Saturday. Yeah. And then for them, it's like Friday at 2 p.m. It was a real mindfuck. But yeah, so like I had never really done public facing anything at that point. Like I definitely thought of myself as someone who was behind the scenes, behind the camera.
Yeah.
But once I got a taste of podcasting, I was like, this is what I have been looking for. You know, I had done a little bit of like writing at that point, and I realized like, oh, when I write an essay or write an article, I'll spend 2 weeks hemming and hawing over like one word or one paragraph. Mm-hmm. With a podcast, you just say it, you just put it out. And so like it really was I was like, this is what I've been looking for. This has been what's missing in my life.
Wow, yeah.
I love that. I really like that. It took me a while to get used to the podcast medium because I got kind of nervous about not being able to edit myself. Like, I feel like we've all messed up, I think, at some point. Like, we've had to, like, we said the wrong thing in the moment or something like that. And because it's podcasting, it's so easy to do that. And for me, I overshare and I have no filter. And so sometimes I just forget what I say. And it's like, I treat it like a really big therapy session each time, which is not healthy, I don't think. I think it just means I need to find a therapist. I think podcasting is pretty amazing in that way because that vulnerability is only possible with this kind of unfiltered medium. And the fact that people have our voices in their ears every week or even twice a week sometimes, like that's like an intimate relationship. And people know about us, stuff about us that like, that's crazy. Like, you know what I mean? People know us very well at this point. So anyway, let's take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. Let's talk about more stuff, including a new show that you have coming up. So we'll be right back.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bizzle Fuma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
And we're back. Okay, I want to talk to you about this new show that you have coming up in a month or so. But before we do that, I want to ask you a question. So I'm curious about how you came into your sexuality, because for me, it was a huge process because I didn't see myself and because I had an upbringing that didn't really seem to mesh well with the person I was inside. I want to know your story, if you're comfortable sharing it, just like a little bit of how you came into yourself and at what point in your timeline did you realize that you were queer?
I think I knew early on, right? When I was a kid, I knew that I didn't feel like all the other girls in my class. Like, I knew that I felt different. Mm-hmm. So I think I had a sense of it even before I really had a sense of what my sexuality was. You know, when I got older, if there was ever a movie or like a show, like I was obsessed with things like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that movie The Craft.
Yep.
Even movies that are not like overtly queer, I was always like adding this. I was like, no, like there's something going on, trust me. Like I...
Oh yeah, same.
Yeah, you know what same. I mean? Like, I think yeah. when you're, you know, when you're marginalized in any way, you can be so thirsty to see yourself reflected that you, like anything that you can get, you'll take. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that I knew early on something that was really hard for me. I've never really even like verbalized this before, so bear with me. Something that was really hard for me was when I was growing up, the story was all about coming out stories. And there was like, you know, like I'm in my 30s, so I remember that episode of Ellen where after the show, she came out on TV and then there was that magazine cover. A lot of the narrative around queerness and being LGBTQ was around a coming out story. And for me, that made me feel very like, I don't even know if alienated is the word. I knew that I didn't have the kind of relationship with my family where it even felt, not that it didn't feel safe, it didn't even feel necessary to have like a big coming out moment, right? And so I would watch these movies and shows about queer people coming out to their family. And I always thought like, oh, that doesn't seem like something that I want to do / need to do / feel would be like useful for me. And so I had to spend a lot of time grappling with what that meant. And honestly, like, it was a lot of my women's studies reading in college, reading folks like Audre Lorde, you know, reading folks like bell hooks that helped me understand that, you know, my sexuality and my understanding of my own sexuality is about myself and how I show up in the world. And if I wanted to have that big coming out moment, I could do that. And people find that really like beautiful and special and empowering. But if that's not how it played out for me, that was also okay. I think being someone for whom my understanding of my gender and my sexuality was very much shaped by what I was seeing in popular culture, because it's just like what I had, understanding the times when those expressions deviated from what I was seeing in pop culture and realizing that like, oh, well, this is my life and that's okay, was really powerful. So I would say like the thing that really helped me was reading books by people like bell hooks and Audre Lorde, a lot of Black queer feminists. And I think now it's like, obviously this shit's not perfect, but I am so happy that young Black and brown queer kids, have people like Janelle Monáe, right? Like have people, mm-hmm. you know, who they can see living these different lives and like being happy and being successful and like being loved. I think so much of what I assumed about being someone who was marginalized for myself being Black and queer was that you were signing yourself up for a life of like misery and turmoil and that you had to, like, it was like your burden, you know, watching movies where queer characters die when they, you know, are queer kind of really reinforced that. And so as powerful as it was for me to understand my own sense of sexuality via popular culture, understanding that this is really my life and I can deviate from that and that I don't have to live a sad life. I can be beautiful and successful and happy and loved and love others and full and nourished and still be myself and still be a Black queer woman raised in the South. Like realizing that you might not see those things play out, but that I can play them out was really, really powerful. I feel like I'm rambling, but I hope that makes sense.
No. I love it. I really love it. And I really relate to it. And it's a good point to bring up that like the narrative that we grew up around was really about suffering if you were queer. And there's still that element to being queer, like where it's not a perfect world and people are still ostracized and there's so much prejudice. But I also didn't have a big coming out thing with my family, more so because like I don't think it made sense. But I did tell my mom at some point, and she had that same idea where it's like she didn't want me to suffer. You know what I mean? She just thought my life would be harder. I also really love that we have people like Janelle Monáe and people that are just so out and proud and beautiful and multifaceted. And they're not just like this one type of gay. They're not one type of queer. They're just beautiful people all around. Not that they weren't beautiful back then, but there was a very distinct narrative. I really resonated with your story, and I'm glad that you brought that up. It's just like our sexuality is how we carry ourselves, and it's not for mm-hmm. anyone else. It doesn't have to be performative, and it can be a big coming out thing if you want it to be, but it's really just about you. And I've always known I was queer, like similar to you. I just knew I was different when I was a kid, and how that manifested when I was a kid was like a lot of shame and secrets and growing up. And you realize that, like, I'm different, but it's good. I think it's just, like, a good shift, you know? But there is the moment where you have to change that shame into something better, and it's really hard.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it, you know? I would say that my adolescence was characterized by shame and secrets, right? Like, that, like those are the things that, like, were most salient in my life growing up. And, you know, we can just have better lives, like, we don't have to live like that if it's not serving us. And, you know, life is short. You don't know how much time we have here. And so it's like, we just gotta live out loud and say, fuck it. Like, I'm just like, so like, I look back at myself when I was young, at that person who was so afraid and so ashamed. And like, I always felt like someone was gonna like, look at me too hard and like, see something in me that I was like trying to hide and obscure. And I'm just so happy that I grew up. And that girl is still inside of me, but like, I'm just so happy. I think that she'd be so proud to see the life that I have today, you know, where I have no secrets. I tell all my business on a podcast.
Same. I'm completely unfiltered. But I agree. I really like that sentiment. And I remember being so proud of myself for being able to live like a really convincing double life. Like I was so proud of my ability to lie well. I remember thinking it was like my biggest skill. Like I am a great liar and I'm going to live a double life my whole life. Like I just accepted that as like, this is just how it is. But I do feel for that younger version of myself, and I hope that I can, and she's still there. It's the same with you. She's still fucking there, but you just have to fucking be kind to ourselves. And I don't know. Anyways, enough sap. Thank you for talking about that.
I wanted to say, with me. You brought up Ellen as someone who was like the whole coming out story. And recently I've been thinking, because Ellen has, you know, it's finally coming out that Ellen's a monster.
She's a monster.
Right. Yeah, I just thought. Yep. But I was recently thinking like how in the same way she's still doing justice in a weird thing by like normalizing a lesbian in power who is also like just as terrible as any other white man in power.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like, I was thinking that the other day, and I was like, God, I mean, like, in a way, she's still she, you know, like she's like she's hanging out with war criminals.
Yes, like absolutely.
Hey guys, you can be gay, you can be part of the LGBTQ community, and still look, guys, it's we're just like you, and it might actually do some good in like communities where they still are very backwards when it comes to like LGBTQ, like. Even the concept of it is like, look, dude, she's rich and famous and just as terrible as any other white guy who's rich and famous and in power. Because you got Ellen just being a monster.
I'm so glad that you're bringing this up. I agree 1,000%. So if folks don't know, Ellen is the worst. I have been like not so into Ellen for a long time. And I'm glad that like the public sentiment is finally turning on Ellen. But it is kind of helpful in that Just because you're gay, just because you're, like, in some cases, just because you're black, like, it doesn't mean that you can't be terrible, that you can't perpetuate the same fucked up, toxic, shitty systems. Yeah. And I think, you know, in a kind of way, you're right? Like, she's kind of a champion of representation in terms of being awful.
Yeah. I was literally thinking that, like, wow, how dumb, but at the same time, pretty funny.
That's
like,
really funny.
She's still so doing funny. It.
She's still breaking fucking ceilings out here. You know what I mean?
Definitely. If y'all watch the show on Hulu, Shrill, it's a great show. You should definitely watch it. But her boss on that show is like a particular kind of white gay man who clearly thinks of himself as like edgy and like, you know, like I'm not the man, but he is the man. You know, like it's her boss and he's like shitty and he's like kind of fucked up to her. And yeah, I think. For a while, people thought like, oh, if you're gay or if you're marginalized, you can't, you're like not able to perpetuate shitty systems, but that's not true.
Yeah. Which I think helps push the everyone is the same, regardless of your sexuality, gender, doesn't matter. We're all the same. So fuck with all the judgment. Like, get out of here.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know? They can perpetuate
the system. You can be a monster too.
Yeah. Anyone can be a monster. We're all the same. We all react to power similarly in the sense that we all of a sudden get drunk on it.
Yep. Yeah. That's a good point. Some people assume that if you're marginalized, it's like holier than thou, but that's like furthest from the truth. Like, fuck it. Like, yeah. Like, it doesn't matter what you are. You can be a fucking monster. But okay, we're winding down to the last couple of minutes of the show. I want to quickly talk about the show that you have coming up on iHeart. Tell us about it. Tell us about what you're working on. When can we hear it?
Yes, thank you for asking. So I have a new show coming out on iHeartMedia, this very network, called There Are No Girls on the Internet. It drops on July 7th, and it's really meant to be an exploration of the intersection of gender, technology and the internet, and culture. You know, we assume that the default person online is like a white cis dude. We just assume that. But actually, women and other marginalized voices, like we were at the earliest days of computing and technology, we were there, right? Like we were the early shapers of what it meant to be on a computer. And so, you know, through very specific systemic issues, women and other marginalized voices were pushed out of that sector. And we sort of started associating it with like men. But even today, women are still creating culture online and shaping what it means to be online. Yet we still don't talk about those voices as like the dominant voice of what it means to be on the internet. And I want to change that. You know, I think that we need to build monuments to what these marginalized writers and artists and technologists and activists and organizers were all doing online. Otherwise, we won't remember them. And so really, it's a tech show about how women and other marginalized voices are shaping the internet and have been since the very beginning.
That's cool.
Dude, that sounds awesome.
It's too real.
Thank you.
I'm so obsessed with that idea. I really like that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the idea sort of came to me because, honestly, it sounds so stupid. I just got so sick of this assumption that when someone is online, it's a white dude. And so often, that's not the case. Like, I think technology is such a broad thing that if we make it such that, like, the only voices that we amplify in that space are men, we are doing a real disservice. And so I just want to build those monuments and have those conversations that make us understand how beautiful and diverse and multifaceted tech culture actually really is.
I can't wait. It's going to be a great show. It's going to be a fucking great show. I cannot wait. So, especially just like you think that technology is like this great equalizer, but it's really not, because exactly, you're right. People assume it's just a white dude all the time, a white cis dude.
Exactly. Well, I can't wait to have the both of you on. Technology is everything, right? Like, it runs through all that we do. So as podcasters, like, y'all are people in tech, voices who are using the internet to shape culture, right? Like, we need to start changing the way that we think about tech leaders. You know, we are all tech leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are. We've come a long way, man.
We've come a long way, baby.
Does anyone notice? No, no one's noticed. That's the problem. No.
We have Ellen to thank. We have Ellen to thank for all of this progress.
I'm kidding. Yeah, thanks, Ellen.
Never.
Continue hanging out with war criminals.
Yeah, exactly.
And harassing everyone around you.
Monster. Yeah. This has been such a good conversation. I think favorite conversations are the ones where, like, I don't even realize an hour has passed because we're just talking about the best, most cathartic things. So I really thank you for being so, I don't know, open and candid and sharing your story. And I feel like there's so much more to unpack with you. You're going to have to come back on.
Yeah.
Anytime. Honestly, in the quarantine, like, I feel rejuvenated. I needed this. So thank you.
Well, thanks for messaging me and being like, I have a setup. Because I was like, well,
you will never be able to get out of my claws.
It's true. I'm so glad. I know that so many people can relate to what you talked about just from, I don't know, from everything. I'm so grateful that you exist. Where can our listeners find you on the internet? Plug in the show one more time and the date and everything, just so everyone has a good idea of where to find you.
Yes. My new podcast is called There Are No Girls on the Internet. It debuts on iHeartMedia on July 7th. You can find it on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find me on Instagram at Bridget Marie in DC. And you can find me on Twitter at Bridget Marie. And please keep in touch, because I love talking to people and I'm hella bored because of the quarantine.
Yeah. And we'll have all the info for the show and Bridget's info in the description in the episode. Yes. So please check it out. Stay tuned for the 7th of July. July, right? Yes. And honestly, it'll come around before we know it.
I hope so.
So I'm going to wrap us out. This is Ethnically Ambiguous. This is Ethnically Ambed, AMB on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, AMBIG on Instagram. I am Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosni on Twitter, just always around.
Honestly, you crush Twitter. You're a Twitter queen.
Got nothing to do, baby.
But yeah, thanks so much for listening to this episode and supporting our show. And I really appreciate everyone that has made us and kept us a part of their world during this time. So thank you guys. And until next time, Anna, do you want to ask me something that our one listener missed?
Do you want to bite that ass?
I'd bite that ass. Okay, no. Bye!
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pitbull, Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.